Margaret E. Canfield is being interviewed today as a member of the Women's Overseas Service League San Antonio Unit. This is January the 15th, 2004, and we are recording at the Army Residence Community in San Antonio, Texas. Ruth Stewart is doing the interviewing, assisted by Carol Hapgood. Margaret, would you start? Do you prefer being called Margaret or Marge?
Margaret. Fine.
Okay. Margaret, would you start by telling us a little bit about your very early life, which led you into the life that you are going to tell us more about?
Well, I was born in Detroit, Michigan, 1930, and during the Depression, we were on welfare. And my first experience with nursing was when I went to the hospital to have my tonsils out, and it was the city hospital. And the nurses were just as kind and gentle as they could be with all the children that were there at that time. And there were a lot of children because all the welfare children were in the same ward. And I think that was my first inkling that I might want to be a nurse when I grew up.
How old were you at that time?
Oh, I think I was about maybe five.
Pretty young.
Like that, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So. And all I can remember is from then on, everything that had to do with nursing interested me. And my mother always made costumes for Halloween or something, and she always made me a nurse. Mm-hmm. And when I started reading books, I started reading all the books I could find that were about nurses.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then during World War II, when they had the student nurse program, or they had the blue
cadet nurse.
The cadet nurse program, yeah. I had a cousin who became a cadet nurse. And I think that's when I thought, well, maybe I'd like to join the Army. So I did go into nursing right out of high school. I was only 17, so we had to sign a waiver for that.
Mm-hmm.
And I went to a hospital school of nursing in Detroit.
Which hospital was
St.
that?
St. Mary's. But I didn't graduate from that school because the nuns sold that hospital and transferred us to another hospital, Providence Hospital in Detroit. I graduated from there in 1951 and had it in my mind from the very beginning that I wanted to be an Army nurse.
Because of your cousin, you think?
Yes, and, you know, the war. You know, you saw a lot about medical personnel, nurses, etc. during the war. So I went down to the recruiter in Detroit and found out that I couldn't join yet because I wasn't 21 and I couldn't take state boards. I was only 19 when I graduated. So I went back to work in the operating room at what was then called Detroit Memorial Hospital. It had been St. Mary's, but the doctors bought it and renamed it Detroit Memorial. So in July of that year, I was able to take state boards. And then went right back to the recruiter as soon as I got the results of my state boards and signed the papers. So then it was, that was in October that everything came through. And I went to basic in November of 1951, and there was another nurse at the hospital that wanted to go in too, so the recruiter arranged that we could go together to basic. Well, neither one of us had ever heard of Fort Sam Houston, but we got on an airplane to come to Texas, and when we got off, we said, well, now how do we get to Fort Sam Houston? And they said, well, that's in San Antonio, Texas. And we were in Houston, Texas. So we had to stay there overnight, and then finally we got sent to San Antonio the next day.
Fort Sam Houston? It sounds right. Like it ought to be in Houston,
right.
Doesn't it? What a story.
At that time, basic training was only 5 weeks because it was during the Korean War, and they wanted to get everybody out in a hurry.
Mm-hmm.
But we lived over in the quadrangle, and it was my first experience living with so many people. I think there were like 18 of us in one room. And we had a little cot and one little locker and a dresser. And we went through all the inspections just like anybody else did and had to have the beds made just so. And very little room for anything. So there were a few girls who had cars. So on Friday night before inspection, we'd unload everything out of our lockers and our dressers and take them down and stack them in the cars until after inspection.
That's an interesting tidbit.
So after basic, I was assigned to then Camp Carson, Colorado. And the first chief nurse I had was Major Yeager, her name was. And she took me to my first quarters. And I was amazed because the bathtub was dirty and she cleaned that bathtub. The chief nurse cleaned that bathtub.
She won your respect right off.
Yes, she did. She certainly did. Mm-hmm. And in that assignment, right after I got there, Fitzsimmons in Denver was renovating their TB section. So they moved their TB patients down to Camp Carson. So we had to open all these old wards that hadn't been used for quite a while. And we had probably, I would say maybe 8 wards full of TB patients. And I was working in that section. And on night duty, you would do the whole ramp. One nurse would take care of all the wards. Could be 6 wards on a ramp. And you had one corpsman on each ward. And also at that time, you had to do breakfast. Food service sent the food down to be cooked, but we cooked the breakfast.
Not just serving it,
you served it. No, the nurse and the corpsman on each ward cooked breakfast for the patients in those days. And of course, we had a lot of ambulatory patients. And they did all the cleanup of the trays, setting up the trays, serving the trays. And that was before food service took over all that work. So, but the TB patients were quite interesting. They were very ingenious in hiding things. You would find bottles of liquor on a string tied down into the shower drain, tied onto the drain, and the bottle would be down into the drain. And they also found ways to have things brought in, like have a taxi come in and bring them illegal things. In those days, it was mostly liquor. Sometimes it was women. Oh, yeah. We'd have a few surprises when you were on night duty and find some women visiting in the ward. But after a few months on that service, I was able to get back into the operating room. I did not have the ORMOS, however. And about 6 months later, 2 nurses with operating room MOSs came in, so I had to leave the operating room. And they needed somebody in OB, which was not my favorite service at that time, but I said, okay, I'll go to OB. And eventually that became my MOS. I really started to love doing obstetrics and did that for the whole time I was at Carson. Then I got assigned to Japan in 1953 up on Hokkaido. And up there, the nurses did everything. I mean, you did medical, surgical, what obstetrics we did have, and even sometimes operating room. It was a fairly small hospital, but we supported the HCAB. And we did get some patients in from Korea, but mostly...
This was what year then?
1953.
Okay, during the Korean... The end of the Korean War.
The end of the Korean War. Mm-hmm. It was quite interesting up there in Hokkaido. It was wintertime almost 8 months of the year, and we had a commander who was an avid skier, So he made sure that there was transportation almost every day for people to go to the ski slopes, which were close by. So about everybody there took advantage of that, even though people had not ever skied before, and I was one of those people. So it wasn't unusual to see people running around with their arms in a cast or legs in a cast. There were always two or three people in casts or in slings or something from ski accidents, but somehow we all managed to work.
But you did learn to ski?
Did learn to ski, yes.
Did you enjoy it?
Oh, yes, very much. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Did you do any when you came back to the States?
Yes, I did. Not a lot, but when I was stationed at Fort Belvoir, I used to go up to Pennsylvania sometimes and ski. Mm-hmm. And then when I was stationed in Utah, mm-hmm. I did. When I came back from Japan, I went to Fort Belvoir in Virginia, where I continued as an OB nurse. And my first experience living off base. At that time, the quarters were pretty full, so they allowed some people to live off base and collect quarters allowance. So,
how was that different for you?
Well, I was used to living in the quarters with somebody. Usually, you know, you had a roommate, and I think I was a little lonely sometimes. I worked night duty most of the time, so I slept a lot during the day. Then one of the nurses I worked with on OB had a sister who was a school teacher on the base. And they had lived in an apartment in Washington, and they wanted to move closer to Fort Belvoir. So they asked me if I'd like to live with them, and so the three of us rented a house. And that was very nice, very nice. So the three of us lived together the whole time we were at Fort Belvoir. From Belvoir, I came down here to Fort Sam, and that was in 57. And I went to the head nurse. It was called Ward Administration and Teaching. And it was the 8AF 3CAT class that they had. It was a 6-month course. And we all lived together in, what was the name? Oh, I can't even think of the name. One of the new buildings here, which was very nice. And we had all our classes over in the quadrangle. After that, I got assigned to Tooele, Utah, where there was an ordnance depot up there in Tooele, Utah. There were civilian nurses running that place up until about a year before we got assigned there. And they started sending Army nurses up there because there was some question of how much work had to be done. And there was a lot of overtime being put in for. Well, when we got up there, we were the second group of Army nurses. Actually, we didn't have any patients in the hospital for like almost 80 days. So they closed the hospital, and we ran three dispensaries, one at the hospital, one down in the maintenance area, and one 17 miles away in the desert. And that's where they stored all the gases, mustard gas and things like that. It wasn't too great an assignment as far as expanding our experiences, because we didn't do very much except physicals on civilians and the few military we had. And occasionally there'd be a minor accident down in the industrial area. And I remember only one incident where we had somebody who was exposed to mustard gas. And other than that, it was merely being there and keeping up supplies and things like that. But the interesting thing at that time, one of the other nurses and I took call every other weekend. And when I was off, I had an opportunity to chaperone children 8 to 15 years old. The school, the newspaper ran a ski school for children 8 to 15, and they needed chaperones to ride the buses up to the ski slopes. So every other weekend, I acted as a chaperone and got to go up to Brighton and Alta in Utah and ski.
Did you have any experience with the kids? Or just?
Actually, once we got up there, the ski instructors took over, and so I was free to ski.
Mm-hmm.
So we really getting them on and off the bus and being on the bus with them
mm-hmm.
there and back.
Mm-hmm.
After my...
What did you do for recreation there? You said there was, didn't sound like there was a whole lot of... professional activity there,
no,
and you did
wasn't.
Ski, but was
well,
there
we,
other?
Well, we did have a bowling alley, and we did have a little officers' club. So there was socializing. There weren't really very many military people assigned there. There were, let's see, three doctors, and three Army nurses, and. Few military down in the industrial areas, and a few enlisted people, but I can't remember how many were there, but really not very many military. Most of the workers on the base were civilians that lived in the area,
mm-hmm.
in Sorella.
Mm-hmm. So. Yeah. Well, was the purpose of your being there because of the gases that were being stored out there? Or?
Well, you had to have some personnel, medical personnel there in case
because
of emergencies, because of the gases. Yeah. That was out at the desert, yeah, Deseret.
Yeah.
In the main depot itself, they used a lot of trichloroethylene, cleaning engines and things like that. It was an ordnance depot,
mm-hmm.
not ammunition
mm-hmm.
At that point. It was mostly vehicles,
mm-hmm.
maintaining vehicles.
Mm-hmm.
And there would be accidents now and then, but nothing serious the whole time I was there.
Mm-hmm.
So, we put on Band-Aids and we treated cuts and bruises and things like that, but
mm-hmm.
not much of anything else.
And how long were you there?
I was there, let's see, 18 months.
And you were ready to go?
I was ready to go, yes. I wanted to get back to work, actually. I really did want to get back to work. So I asked to go to Hawaii, and I did get the assignment to Tripler General Hospital in Hawaii. And I went back to obstetrics when I got there.
You keep going back to obstetrics, don't you?
I did, yeah, I guess really, although that was not my preference when I went into the Army, I really loved it. So it was a happy place to work mm-hmm. most of the time. Yeah.
Yeah.
But while I was at Tripler, I did attend the University of Hawaii evening courses. I worked mostly night duty for the first few years in labor and delivery. And then I became a head nurse in labor and delivery. And I was lucky. I was able to stay in Hawaii for, I think it was 4 years and 8 months.
A long time.
It was a long time, but the Berlin crisis had occurred during that time, and they weren't moving people. And I found out that you could stay up to a period of 5 years in equal 6 month increments. So I quick went down and signed up to stay.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So.
And did you finish a degree then?
No, I didn't.
You didn't?
No. And I did not come back to CONUS the whole time I was there. So I finally, the last year I was there, I took some leave. And I took a trip to India and Thailand and Hong Kong. And I was able to get transportation on one of the military flights, the whole way there and the whole way back. So that, most of the other times I took leave was to study for exams or something like that.
You were a dedicated student, weren't you?
No, I just took one class, like, you know, several semesters. I think I went about 3 or 4 semesters while I was there. But I never did finish my degree.
Mm-hmm.
So after Hawaii, I went to Fort Hood, Texas. And I was on OB. And we were in the old cantonment type hospital where you could see in the delivery room, you could look down through the floorboards and see all the bugs crawling on the ground. And we'd find them in the cribs in the nursery, the crickets, in the cribs with the babies. Somehow everybody managed to survive. but we're building a new hospital at that time. So I was able to have some input as to what was going to be in the labor and delivery, and the whole OB section, actually. And that was interesting. I had a good friend who was one of the project officers, was the nurse project officer on that. So I worked with her a lot and learned a lot about ordering equipment and setting up the units and things like that, and that was interesting. And we did move to the new hospital while I was still there. And shortly after we moved there, we had a manpower survey. And our chief nurse had just left, and we didn't have a new chief nurse yet. And the assistant chief nurse had a husband, and she was not interested in spending a lot of extra time there. So two sergeants and this friend of mine who had been the project officer and I did the whole manpower survey for nursing service for that hospital without any statistics.
Now, what did this include?
Well, it included writing up what you needed, you know, to run the service, each ward, for every section, each ward, each clinic, etc., as far as the nursing service went.
The personnel
what your
part.
Requirements were
mm-hmm.
for that. And you had a narrative, and you had to have statistics, you know, to back it all up. Well, unfortunately, the four of us had to make it all up because we just moved to that hospital, and so we had no real statistics
that. You were doing educated guessing.
Educated guessing.
Yeah.
We did take what we had from the old hospital, but the configuration of the wards and things weren't the same anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So years later, this friend of mine was working up in SDO, and somebody said to her, "Were you at Fort Hood when that manpower survey was done?" And she just laughed. She had been one of the people who had to do this.
Mm-hmm.
But we got a lot of laughs out of that. But we worked very hard and till midnight some nights, trying to write all this stuff as honestly as we could with the little statistics that we had. But then we did get a new chief nurse in. And my friend and I both, and another nurse, decided we all wanted to go to Vietnam. So we all went down at the same time and signed up to go. Needless to say, the chief nurse was not very happy with us, with three of us doing it. But I'm the only one of the three that went at that time. And that was in February of 1967. And I went over with the unit from the 91st EVAC with all the nursing, the nurses. The men had already been over there. And when we got there, the hospital was not open yet. It had been built, but there was still a lot to do to set up the different wards and open the equipment and get things set up. And we did a lot of scrounging from the Air Force too for things like paint, to paint things, and it took us probably about 2 to 3 weeks to set up enough that we could start getting patients in. So,
what kind of a building were you in?
We were in permanent type buildings, like Quonset.
Okay.
Hut type. And at that time I was head nurse in surgical intensive care and recovery. And we did get a lot of Vietnam civilians in at first, more than we did American casualties.
What were the conditions under which you would get them?
Well, they were wounded. They had shrapnel wounds, or they had, actually, some had bullet wounds.
Mm-hmm.
And we did get some Vietnam prisoners. And that was really kind of interesting. I can remember several of them that we really got to know quite well. And, you know, they would show us pictures of their families, and it was hard to dislike these people.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they were just like anybody else.
Yeah.
And they had families who they worried about and were worried about them. And I think we gave them care that was as good as we would give to anybody. Then we did start getting some U.S. casualties in, and also some Koreans from the Korean forces. But I was only there until...
You weren't an OB at that time.
No, I was...
You finally got out of babies.
I was in surgical intensive care and recovery. Well, after we were there about, I think, 6 weeks or so, they decided to start moving people around so that we would not all have the same deer rope. Since we all went over at the same time, they didn't want us to all leave at the same time.
Mm.
So I was sent to Kwaku as chief nurse of the 18th Surgical Hospital.
And that's in Vietnam?
Yes, in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And so you were chief nurse there then?
Yes.
Uh-huh. And that was your first experience as chief nurse?
Yes, it
How
was.
Did that feel?
A little bit scary, but we were so busy, other than some of the paperwork I had to do and, just looking after the nurses somewhat, I worked just like anybody else did. I worked mostly in the pre-op and receiving area when we get the casualties in.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, everybody went to work when you got a bunch of casualties in.
Mm-hmm.
So, and that... at that time, they were building the 71st EVAC up in Kwaku. So when that hospital was finished, they were planning to close the 18th Surge and move it up north farther. Well, then they decided to make it an all-male unit. So all the female nurses had to be reassigned. And I had, that was in October. So I still had until the following February on my tour of duty. And I talked to the chief nurse of Vietnam at that time and said I would be willing to stay another year, an extra year, if I could go to another surgical hospital. So she agreed that I could stay, and I would go down to the 3rd Surgical Hospital in Don Tan in December of that year. In the meantime, I was to stay up and work at the 71st EVAC, and that's where several of the nurses who were going to be derosing in the next few months worked. And we still lived in our quarters at the 183rd, and they drove us back and forth in ambulances to the 71st and back. So I was up there several months, and while I was there, they had the Dachau incident, and there were lots and lots of wounded. In fact, sometimes we would just leave work and get back to our own quarters and get to bed, and they'd call and say, come back to work again, because they were bringing in the wounded by Chinook loads. So that was my first experience with real severe wounds of head and neck and other neurological problems, because up there at the 71st back they had the neurosurgeons. And I worked as night supervisor up there. So again, I spent most of my time in the pre-op triage area working.
How did this affect you to have all these severely wounded coming in during that time?
You don't think about it much at the time. I mean, the whole time I was in Vietnam, I was fine with it. But I did find when I came back, and still, I do not like to watch movies about the war or read books on the Vietnam War. I just can't do it. Mm-hmm. But while I was there, I mean, I had a job to do. And I think I was so busy that I really,
mm-hmm.
it really didn't bother me too much.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The only time it did was when we had a bunch of, they were DOA that came in. And they had been out there in the field for quite a while before they could get to them. And they had the bags all laid out on the helicopter pad. And I caught some of the people over there taking pictures. And that upset me a lot,
mm-hmm.
to think that people would go try to take pictures of these poor men laying there.
Yeah.
But other than that, like I said, we were kept so busy most of the time that you didn't have time to feel really sad.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What was it like for you to live there then during that period? You were very, very busy. Did you have any time to get away, to relax, to do anything?
Well, when I was up in Pleiku, we weren't real busy when I was at the 183rd. I mean, we were always full of patients, and we had what we call a push every now and then when we'd get a lot of casualties in, but then we'd have times when it was fairly quiet, because before the 71st evac opened up, then we had to evac our patients to like the 65th or the 67th evac. So after we would stabilize the patients at the surgical hospital, then we would evac them someplace else. The only patients that we kept were patients who had malaria, who might not be there too long and we could get back to duty, or minor injuries that we could get back to duty.
Mm-hmm.
So there were times when we weren't real busy. And we had a little club, so we could go over there and listen to music or work puzzles or, do things like that.
Mm-hmm. And you lived in barracks, did you?
Yes, we did.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Right.
In fact, the officers' barracks, the nurses lived downstairs, and the doctors and the administrative officers lived upstairs.
Assuming those were all male then.
Yes.
The doctors.
Well, they were. Yes, at that time they were all male.
Were they separating by occupation or gender?
It just worked out there.
Yeah.
But we did have a few male, I did have a few male nurses, and they lived upstairs with the men, that's true.
Yeah.
Yeah, right. So, when I left the Play Cool and the 71st back, finally, I went down to Dongtan to the 3rd Surgical Hospital, which was a MUST unit, one of the inflatable hospitals.
Mm-hmm.
And that was in December of 67.
To where was that?
Dongtan, D-O-N-G-T-A-M, Dongtan. It was down in the Delta. That was south of Saigon. And we were very busy down there. We took care of a lot of Marines and a lot of Navy, as well as the 9th Infantry Division. We supported the 9th Infantry Division. And at that time, they were all up, most of them were up at Bearcat, north of us. But we did get in the wounded from them. Later on, the 9th Infantry Division moved down to Dongtan. But we had a lot of wounded come in down there. We were busy all the time down there. But during Tet of 68, we were under mortar fire a lot. In fact, during Tet, I think we had 52 direct hits on our compound. And our hospital was more or less destroyed. Of course, being an inflatable, any little bits of shrapnel could put you almost out of business.
Mm-hmm.
And we, at that time, we had to evac most of our patients every night. All those that we could evac, we would get out of there, because come nighttime, we knew that we were going to get mortared. So any patient that we were able to safely move, we would evac. And other patients that we couldn't evac but we could move, we would put into bunkers that we had beside each ward. And some of those were just big conexes that were surrounded by sandbags. And if we couldn't move them, we had patients on respirators, we would just put them under the beds and try to keep them as safe as possible. We never slept in our quarters, we slept in a bunker. And it started out, we just slept in the dirt on the floor. Then the engineers one night, two of them were walking by when the mortar attack started, and they darted into our bunker and saw how we were sleeping. And so they came over and they suspended litters from the ceiling and they put up cots for us, so we at least weren't sleeping in the dirt anymore. But we did have 3 direct hits on our nurses' quarters during that period. Unfortunately, nobody was in there.
Mm-hmm.
I remember one night we had evac'd just about all our patients, and I went over to the surgical ward to help the nurses that were there and the corpsmen clean up so we could be ready the next day or whenever we got more wounded in, and we started getting mortared. And all we could do was crawl under the beds and wait till it was over with. And I just said, everybody get to the bunkers and we'll worry about cleaning all this stuff up another time. So this is a little bit funny. The other 2 nurses and I went back to where our quarters were. And, of course, we had outside latrines at that time, and all 3 of us were in there when a mortar hit right behind us. And you never saw 3 people run so fast with their fatigue still down around their ankles. And we ran to the nearest bunker, which was right outside our quarters there, and spent the rest of the night, the 3 of us, huddled in that small bunker.
Mm.
And I can remember we were shaking so hard, the 3 of us, our knees were bumping together, all 3 of us.
Mm-hmm.
And the bunker was hit just on the edge, on the outside, But everybody was safe. Everybody was safe. And as far as I can remember, we had two members of the unit wounded, but they were two lab technicians who did not go to the bunker, who wanted to stay out in the open and take pictures of the mortars coming in. But those were the only casualties from our unit, and it was their own fault that they got wounded. They had minor shrapnel wounds. Fortunately, it wasn't anything serious. So after Vietnam, I spent almost 21 months in Vietnam, and I came back and was assigned to Fort Gordon, Georgia, where I went once again back to OB. But I wasn't there too long when I was made afternoon supervisor. And that assignment didn't last very long because the chief nurse down at Hunter Army Airfield in Savannah, Georgia, decided to retire, and they sent me down there as chief nurse. So I was at Hunter Army Airfield
Army Airfield.
Hunter Army Airfield.
When it was still combined then. I mean, when it was Army Air Force.
No. It was called Army Airfield, though. It had been an Air Force base, but it became an Army Airfield, and it was a helicopter base.
I see. Okay, it wasn't the Army Air Corps then.
No,
it was just called
Hunter Army Airfield.
Okay.
In Savannah, Georgia.
Okay.
And we were quite busy there. Fort Stewart was not too far away, but they, at that time, had no surgical capability. So all the troops that they had down there and all the dependents that required surgery and delivery, the pregnant women, they were all sent up to Hunter Army Airfield. So we were very busy. And the chief nurse down at Stewart became a good friend of mine. And so she would send some of her nurses up occasionally for them to get some experience,
mm-hmm.
Particularly in the OB section and operating room.
Mm-hmm.
So, and while I was there, they refurbished the whole hospital, so I had an opportunity to do some nice things in some of the mm-hmm. wards there, as far as colorful curtains, drapes, and bedside curtains
mm-hmm.
and things like
mm-hmm.
that.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was another interesting experience. From there, I went to Germany, and I was chief nurse at the 2nd General Hospital in Landstuhl, Germany, for 2 years. Had quite a number of opportunities to travel while I was there. And it was very interesting. When I was down at Fort Sam at the course in 1957, I had met some Air Force nurses, and it turned out that one of them, who had been my best friend at that time, was the chief nurse at Ramstein Air Force Base, which was right across the road, practically, from Landstuhl. So the two of us did most of our traveling together.
Mm-hmm.
We were both able to get away because we were in different,
mm-hmm.
different units. And so we renewed our friendship and did a lot of traveling to Greece and to Spain and Austria.
Great.
Mm-hmm. While I was at Landstuhl, they were talking about getting the prisoners released that were, was it Iran that all those people were prisoners?
Mm-hmm.
And they thought maybe they might be coming through our area, so we had to prepare some of the wards to take care of them.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I'm sorry, that's wrong. Excuse me. These were prisoners from Vietnam, not from Iran. They were the PIs, the POWs.
Okay.
And so we had to prepare a lot of wards to get ready for them. And it was sort of a secret thing. I had to get these things ready, but I wasn't able to tell any of the staff,
why?
My nurses, why we were doing all this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But as it turned out, they didn't send them through there after all. But that was a different experience. So
you've had a variety of experience, for sure.
Yeah. Well, when I was due to leave there, I got orders for William Beaumont. I had asked to go back to obstetrics. My father had been diagnosed with cancer, and I felt that I probably wouldn't be staying in too much longer. So I decided I'd like to go back to obstetrics just to finish up what little time I might have left in the service. So I was chief of maternal and child health care at William Beaumont Army Medical Center.
And that's El Paso?
El Paso, Texas. Uh-huh.
So you started in Texas and you ended in Texas. And you're still in Texas.
Yeah, I'm still in Texas. Anyway, yeah. So it was 1974, and I decided that, it was 75. I decided I had better retire and go home because my father was terminal and my mother was not well. So I did put in my retirement papers, and in August of that year, I retired.
And how many years has that been?
24.
What were the highlights of your military career?
Well, my experience in Vietnam was the biggest thing. And one of the things that I remember most is how cooperative everybody was.
Throughout your career?
Well, in Vietnam particularly. Okay. And how everybody worked together and nobody complained. And then when I came back and I went to Fort Gordon, I had a hard time, I think, at first, because things were so different. I mean, people complained if they had to work any overtime or come back and cover another shift or go work on another ward to help somebody out.
Mm-hmm.
It was such a drastic change from the way things were in Vietnam,
mm-hmm.
even though, you know, the work situation wasn't the greatest in Vietnam, but the people were.
Mm-hmm.
The people were the greatest.
Mm-hmm. As a nurse, then, how do you reflect on your career as a nurse in terms of what your nursing did for you or what you did for nursing?
Oh, goodness, that's difficult to answer. I'm not sure that I contributed a whole lot to any advances in nursing. I think I did a good job at what I was doing.
Mm-hmm. Sounds to me like you were an excellent role model. You must have done some teaching along the way, and certainly your behavior reflected that.
Well, yeah, you know, of course you always teach the younger ones who are coming up, and while I was at Tripler, I did teach maternal and child health care classes to, you know, the pregnant women,
mm-hmm.
that sort of thing. But no real formal classroom type teaching.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It was all on
but
the job.
But teaching is teaching.
Yes.
Yeah. So then you feel that you chose the right career.
Oh, definitely.
Both in nursing and in the military.
Oh, yes. I wouldn't change any of that. No.
And since you retired then, 75, that's been quite a while. What's your life been like since then?
Well, of course, I retired and I went back to Michigan, and I took care of my father. He had lung cancer, and I took care of him until he died in 76, and I came back here to San Antonio. Well, my mother wasn't well, so in 1980, I went back for 4 years and took care of my mother, and after she died, I came back to San Antonio again, and by that time, of course, I was so far behind as far as nursing that it wouldn't have been safe for me to go back into nursing. So I just did volunteer work.
What kind of volunteer work?
I worked for the Army Medical Museum Foundation. At that time, we were soliciting funds, mm-hmm. you know, to build the museum.
Mm-hmm.
So I've worked for them ever since, actually about 1978, I started working. And I was on the board of directors, on the executive board for a couple of years, and I'm still on the board of directors.
Mm-hmm.
And I volunteer at the gift shop, Army Medical Museum Foundation gift shop.
Mm-hmm.
And for 7 years, I drove the one of the care mobiles at BAMSI. So that mm-hmm. was another one of my jobs. And for a while, I worked for the American Red Cross as a volunteer. And during the, let's see, was it 1985 when they had the... they were afraid of the storms on the coast in Corpus, and they evacuated all the people up here.
About then.
Yeah. I worked some 12-hour shifts at night for the Red Cross in some mm-hmm. of the shelters.
Mm-hmm.
And that was an interesting experience. I worked in one that had air conditioning in the high school, and so they sent a lot of the sick people there, people who were diabetics, cardiacs. A lot of old people that came up from Corpus
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Came there, and we took care of them there.
Mm-hmm.
So I did that at that time.
Once a nurse, always a nurse.
Yeah, but you need to keep up with all the latest trends, and if you're not working, it's very hard to do.
Well, the technical things, yes, technical. But there's a certain process you go through in working with people that you never lose.
Mm-hmm.
It's always a part of you.
Yeah.
So, is there anything else you'd like to finish up with?
Well, one thing I think from my time in the service, we made a lot of friends who were lifelong lasting friends. I don't think that it's true as much today as it used to be. I mean, when we used to live in the quarters and work together all the time, I think, you know, you became very close, almost like a family. And now everybody's married or living off the base, and they hardly know anybody else that works in the same hospital that they work in.
Mm-hmm.
The retiree group here, as a matter of fact, has been known as the White Shoe Mafia.
The which?
White Shoe Mafia. Right. And everybody knows what's going on, and if somebody needs some help, there's somebody there, right there, to help them.
Mm-hmm.
And it's still that way with the older people, the older retirees.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much, Margaret. We really appreciate your taking the time to do this and to record this for the history of our country, the women, and the military, and nursing. So this is an added segment to that history. Thank you very much.